And Roberto is the Francis and Charles Field Curator of Special Collections at Stanford University Libraries, and one of our great friends and a true lover of the arts of the book. And also he is a friend of our next speaker. So I'm going to turn it over to Roberto to come up and introduce Felipe.
Well, it really is a treat to be able to introduce Felipe to you. I first met him about 5 years ago in Mexico City, where we had some great food, drink, and talk, and talk especially about books and his own work. And of course, we subsequently acquired his papers for Stanford University. So his papers are there. Felipe was born in 1943 in Mexico City, initially trained as a printer and a graphic artist. He is recognized within Mexico as a draftsman and a painter. He is better known on an international level for his achievement for his achievements in Orthodox forms of visual communication. He is especially respected as a book artist. While living in England in the early 70s, Ehrenberg co-founded the Polygonal Workshop and later the Bojas Press. Under his guidance, BGP published his work and that of a number of other important visual poets, conceptualists, neo-dadaists, and experimental artists, many of whom were linked to the Fluxus movement. Ehrenberg has held over 100 one-person shows and has participated in some 200 major group shows and biennials in the world's major capitals. He is an assiduous essayist and specializes in art theory and contemporary culture. A selected anthology of his newspaper columns entitled Broken Glasses and the Eye That Looks at Them was published in 1996 by Mexico's Consejo Nacional para la Cultura y los Artes. Most recently, Felipe was the cultural attaché from Mexico to Brazil and had decided to, I think, stay in Brazil for a while. So without further ado, please welcome Felipe.
Peter and Susan, I want to thank you very, very much for insisting. I almost didn't come, and it was not for lack of wanting. It was a tough year last year, and I almost didn't make it over. And of course, I want to thank Roberto and Alan Diego, who gave me such a nice space, such a wonderful space in this area. And I'd like to thank you for coming also. There's a whole bunch of white mustaches. That'd be great. Mustaches are almost archaeological. A sign of the times. This is my second PowerPoint that I make. And I really worked on it. And I showed it to this. I work at a new TV station, a new TV channel that's going to transmit throughout Latin America, Televisión America Latina, in Sao Paulo. And they have this really snazzy design department. And there's this young designer, and I showed it to him very proudly, and he said, "It's horrible." So I asked, "Why?" It's too full of colors. So I decided to keep it that way. And so this, and I'm not quite sure how I'm going to handle this. It's a very big screen, a little one here. And what I'm going to do is let you read when I get tired of talking or when people are tired of this. I'm just going to sort of mix half and half. And I found this quote, and I loved it many, many years ago. And let me see. That's the one that I need. So you read it all, and that's a show now. Read. Actually, Jeremy Bentham, in this philosopher, I never really come close to eccentrics until I met Jeremy in London. And I felt that that was a height of eccentricity and individuality and self-assurance. Just have your body involved, or just brains involved there, and have a yes vote. It's a very positive way of looking at everything after death, and your future and everything. And but it is a fact that that's where I really discovered what a panopticon was. He invented it. And that is how I feel in life. I feel that I'm in the middle of a panopticon, and that the people that I watch do not know what they produce, cause me to produce. We'll find out what a neologist is a little later on. But, that's right, I have to go back again. There we are. I have really never considered myself a book artist. Books do happen to me. And so when Peter asked me to give a talk, I felt that the best way to do it, to show what a fragmentary life can come, how a fragmentary life can come together, was to talk about cut and paste, which is still a very noble art. It's halfway between digitalized and letterpress. So that's what I felt. And this one, this little talk, is dedicated to my one of my littlest granddaughters, April, and she's a San Franciscan. She was born here. I've talked a lot about the Bogès Press here and there, and it's well known, the story of Bogès Press. A lot of the Bogès Press files, all of them, are at the Tate National Gallery. Anybody can walk over to London and check that out. But the Stanford here has all the information that there is to know about it. And Vanessa Kahn wrote a very nice introduction to the files catalog, and it tells a nice story. The story I'm going to tell you now is something that I have never quite told anybody. We moved, my wife and I, to Brazil about 6 years ago, and then decided to stay. I'm no longer, thank God, a diplomat. And I did bring a lot of things back to from Mexico over to Sao Paulo, and I left them in boxes. And I, as I was looking through these boxes, I found, you remember carousel slides? Anybody remember those? But I found one full of fungi, and, really ancient. And I found a whole bunch of old photographs of this. We digitalized them, and here they are. There's a lot of effects. So this year I'll be 50 years of practicing artist. And I'm marking on July the 11th, there's going to be a retrospective show with a really great book, 300 pages. And 50 years is a lot of years. How can I explain that I'm not a book artist, as all my life I've dedicated myself, one way or another, to books? I envy my colleagues, the real book artists, that all they do is book art. I could never stand still. And I could never stand still. And in Mexico, nonconformism, eccentricity, especially amongst the arts people, is absolutely out. You can't be an... If you're a nonconformist, you have to conform to what nonconformists have to be like. So you have to be spattered and everything, but you have to be quite a courtesan. And I never really managed to be a courtesan. So I never managed to court the money that required that an edition requires or that a producing requires. So I figured it out more or less on my own. And by the the time Martha and I arrived in London, we had bought our Gestetner, really one of the very first editions that I published, that I produced on this Gestetner machine, is this horrible photograph that I found. And it has a tampon there that instead of copy would bring out a thought, something to think about. And it's got a little 1 second movie, which is just 24 frames. And I sold it to my friends. I kept two or three of them. They're all squished up in the boxes and everything. So they really look a mess. They look like, just like the photograph. One of the first things that I did in England also, which I enjoyed doing very much, was actually making the guillotine, the big Franklin guillotine that our friend had next door in Islington. And so I played around with his guillotine until he kicked me out. I was doing a whole study, a very deep research into rubbish, to the garbage, they had a garbage strike. So I did a series of sort of flip books, shape them around and everything. It's just actually one image and the guillotine does the rest. I think all my life I wanted to extend the definition of what a book is. I feel that we don't know enough about books. One of the things very few people know is how the Peruvian Inca Empire actually managed all its records and its histories and everything. And they used to make books out of tied strings. It sounds inconceivable, but there's people still up in the mountains in Peru that still use strings to mainly to harvest the crops at the time of the day. And these strings, these I gathered together, certainly must have looked like this. So you could walk into an Inca library made out of strings, colors, the knots, they encrypt knowledge in such a way. And from what I understand, it's very much like our binary system. There's nothing new under the sun. This is where I talk about not talking about the broadcast press, but really I found this wonderful photograph amongst the old photographs of how we did the ISIS in 1972, the ISIS Thomas Alva Edison edition. It had nothing to do with Thomas nor Alva nor Edison. David Mayer thought of the name up and we printed it on a train that ran out of London to Edinburgh. We gathered all the people on the train, amongst them Charlotte Moorman and Carly Sheen and a whole bunch of friends were on that ISIS experimental sound train. And this is the way we produced the book with a duplicate with a mimeograph machine. And by the time we reached Edinburgh, the book had been actually even distributed. Which is what the OJS Press really was about and what life had been about since then. Mexico is a graphic country. There are, in fact, an enormous quantity of stamps, cylindrical stamps made out of clay, both to print on clay as well as to print on metal paper. And of course we had the first printing press ever in the European manner on the continent in Mexico. The Spaniards brought the press. Juan Pablo Zera, the name of the press, Juan Pablo brought it. So we have it in our DNA, printing. And I like the idea of printing. In fact, I printed myself with fire, with knives. I'll show you another one right now. And I like the act of printing, stamping. In Spanish, the word, the graphic museum is el Museo de la Estampa, to stamp something. And I did a series of works, performance pieces, which are really graphic performances. I cut myself and I stamp myself. You see that piece of cloth down below? Well, I cut designs here, and if it weren't for aloe vera, you cut aloe vera. And so you cut a design here, and you print yourself, or I printed myself, I'm not suggesting you do it. And aloe vera cures it all. There's all these little lines. I have it. really enjoy doing, and I can do it anytime you want. You take these rolls, I don't think they exist anymore, these for adding machines, for a long roll of paper, and I cut a little, take the cutter and cut a little four little lines right here. And then I print myself out, and I start printing myself out until the ink runs out or dries out. And it looks like a little bird is walking because those are little three little things. And that is very, I usually do it with my tie and a suit and everything because it's very, it surprises people very much when you do it. And you're wearing a tie, it doesn't surprise you when people wear a tie sign war treaties and stuff like that. But anyway, tattooing, etching. I probably had one of the first tattoos and to be accepted by society. Now, tattoos were very much, you know, not accepted. Every grandmothers now have tattoos. There's grandmothers with tattoos. But at that time, some 40 years ago, tattoos weren't as common as they are today. That tattoo I just had made, the one on the middle of the right, and I kept the toilet paper, which the tattooist printed. The tattoo, here it is. This is a 2,000-year-old design from the Tiahuanaco. And I feel that tattoos and photocopies and all of those things are very much the same impulse, the same impetus. It has to do with stamping, with printing. And in fact, I extended the idea further. It's not just square books or pop-out books or it's everything. One of the things that I did for quite some time, there's a friend, Delgado here, we met in Mexico when the Mexican Council of Photography started. I used to do printed images or graphic images right on in the streets themselves. There was this photocopying shop, I had a little Polaroid, and do photocopying there, and buy print, and glue it up, paste it up, and then just sell it or distribute it to the public. Right then and there, I like that immediacy. I like the surprise of the substance. This, for example, weighs 38 pounds. And that was shown at the Museum of Modern Art in 1980. And the other day when we wanted to photograph it again, they lost it. I mean, the Modern Art in Mexico loses everything, or they throw it in the garbage. They just lost the major. I mean, it's just incredible. They lost the other one down there. I made that with 14th century wood in Erfurt, Germany. And we exported it back to Mexico. And they set it up and they paid a nice price for it. They set it up in the gardens and they lost it. Actually, when you think about it, it's not all that bad. There's so many things here on Earth. If you can keep a photograph, one more. Now, this is another book. I really like this book. I did that in 2001 in Portalegre down south. They have a book fair. They have a wonderful open air book fair that is probably the biggest, the largest open air book fair in the world. They have over 1,200,000 visitors in November. And if you don't know about it, you should go. Howard and Beverly Carno are always down there. They know everything that goes down south. But this book fair is just a remarkable book fair. They have everything there. So I did a book installation piece. If you can see the picture on the right, you can barely see the book. It's made out of fishing rods. And I suspended it over a yellow, can you see the book? Can you manage to see it? I suspended it over yellow sand that I got from there. And we had a big performance piece. It must have been about, I don't know, 1,500 people that came to the performance. And it was dedicated to Érico Veríssimo, who's a major literary figure in Brazil, who wrote a book on Mexico, and Juan Rufo, of course, who became famous for only three books. He only wrote three books. And I liked the idea of Ali Coelho dancing on this virginal sand and leaving his prints on it, the way a book leaves its prints on our soul and our mind and our... another very common printing mechanism, if you want, stamping mechanism, is stencils and sawdust. which is very common throughout all of Latin America and many other countries, and cut the stencils out, and you can print over and over again the motif with colored sawdust. This I did in Australia. It's dedicated to all those who, in homage to all those who died crossing the sea. And actually, it's a raft. And the raft itself is a, what you call it? It's a maritime map. The South Sea Farers used maps, stream maps and stick maps and things like that. It's very interesting. Museum of Maritime Maps in Australia, Sydney. Here again, this is a border theme, the installation, and the colors you see on the cloth are also colored stencils and sawdust. I think of them as graphic works. Stamps, of course, are very important, have always been very important, and I started using stamps very, very, very early on. And using stencils, this stencil work down there is one in, I don't know how many, is 40 years of making stencils. But I did, in Atlanta, Nexus Press, I did an anthology of my stencils, and I did a codex, a codex, and this is down here. Is you can actually close it up like a book or open it up into a big paper sculpture. And that has, it's an anthology of all the stencils, and I like to think of the images that you can create with a stencil are like gifts. I just put that little tiny thing there on the right because I'm just going to tell you a very quick story. We were being visited by a series of writers and editors at home, and one of the writers, she brought a book and gave it to me, and I was very thankful. And her editor said, well, if you like the book, maybe you can illustrate it one of these days. And I said, I'd love to. It would be an honor for me to illustrate it, but why is it always that illustrators have to come after the guys or the woman has written the book? Why isn't it the other way around? And she picked the glove up and she accepted the challenge. And she has started now asking visualizers to visualize images and then giving these images in this order to two writers for each book to illustrate with words. I love that idea because it always is the other way around. So I thought I'd mention it, and I found the photograph there, so I put it in. Comic books are also very important. I grew up with comic books, so who didn't? And just as one day I thought I could make a book and made some, I felt I could make a comic. And this is red, Mexican codices are actually red from the right to left and the bottom in a spiral manner, right? And so I liked the idea of seeing if from a contemporary, if you could, with a drawing, make people read in another way. In other words, a pre-Columbian way. And apparently they followed the story, and they managed to do it. It's not the only the only comic book that I've done, and it's not the Codex Iriscriptus Ehrenbergensis is also read that way, spiral-wise, from the bottom, clockwise, from the bottom, right to left, and to the center. Actually, being an editor is fun, and we like eating, and we like thrillers, and we like detective novels and everything. So Ruth, this was a great cook. She started gathering a group of friends some 15 or 16 years ago, and we meet every Monday at night. Every Monday, and first she cooks, we eat, we all wash our dishes, and then we read our stories. And I mean, you know, there's an engineer there, there's two doctors, there's, you know, nobody writes really stories for a living, but we write the stories and then we publish them and then we sell them in this magazine. It's called Yellow Negro because one of the very important magazines here in English, a pulp magazine, was Black Mask. Anybody remember that one? Black Mask. So we call this Biobo Negro because one mask is not enough to cover a whole group of people, so you need a screen for them, so this black screen. And there we've played around with photo comics and all sorts of things, and it's a tabloid look. And it gets distributed in bookstores, but mainly we go to movies and sell it on the queue outside the movie, and that's where we sell it. Sometimes print up to 2,000 or maybe 1,000, whatever it is, and it has no rate. Sometimes it comes out after 3 months, and sometimes we only bring out one issue a year. It just depends. It's one of those things that we do that happen to us. And here's something that I really got into, and these are the biggest books that I've ever made. These are pop-outs. I love pop-outs. My kids, I used to buy Meckenorm, I Columbia used to print these pop-outs. They used to reproduce Lothar Meckendorf's pop-out books. They're really good, have good technology for that. They print very well there in Columbia. So I decided to make pop-outs, giant wooden pop-outs. After all, the books are made out of paper, which is made out of wood and so on, for some, no big difference. Actually, you can see the little cranks on the sides. And if you crank those things, all the little figures move. These on the other side look like this. They're about spread out when you pop them out. You'll see a few more. They're almost 3 meters high, 3 yards, 9 feet more or less, which are very big and heavy and very big. And I enjoy it very much. One day I opened the newspaper last year, and I found that these big books were, somebody had picked up on the idea in Frankfurt 2 years ago, and they put on these big books. But they were antique. Mines has things in them. It's funny how an idea gets picked up. And these are pop-outs. These are all very large pop-outs. You can actually close them up and save them. And usually when I do these big things, I have to work them out like little, I have to make models. So I have all these little tiny models that are beautiful, jewel-like, that I made for the big ones. So go through a lot of designs. This is the way it looks when you pop out, when that one pops out. Of course, the Spaniards came from the other side of the world, so their ship is upside down, and they run with their horses and so forth. So. Here's another one, which is very Da Vincian. You can close it up and there's broken glasses in the back. I use a whole bunch of reiterate hands and mirrors. And a whole bunch of things that I use all over throughout life. You never know why, but they help your lexicon, your personal lexicon. That same giant exhibition, which was two books with several volumes, everything was absolutely bookish, closed with this one, which is more than a book, it's actually a text. And that big prow up there actually penetrates that circle. And that circle is surrounded with these maize grinders. Now, this show traveled, so only one of them is made out of stone. All the other, the rest of them are foam rubber. But they're so well made, you don't know which one is stone and which one is foam rubber. The corn is all real, though. And, well, the day of the day, you all know about that. And I do a lot of, every year for 30 years I've been doing large, non-traditional Day of the Dead installations that open, have to open, just like a Christmas tree has to be there. You know, the 25th, 24th, 25th. Day of the Dead has to be there on the 1st and 2nd of November, so I figure, you know, I managed to make that, and you can get help from 15, 20, 25 art students, and they all learn about the art of installation, and we make these things out of paper. This is in Bolivia, that's where I have this tattoo, because the Bolivians at that time having a biennial, and at the same time we were trying to keep the president out. It was a president who talked like this: "Señores Bolivianos, tenemos grandes problemas. Es posible que esta revolución de cocaleros se esté siendo financiada por Gaddafi." The guy actually spoke that way. The Bolivian president was raised and grew up in the United States. He barely spoke Spanish. So you think about it. Logical. You don't speak Spanish here. Okay, that's the way he talked. He kicked him out, and we kept on arguing, and we had this great show. And that's a salt circle in the middle of the installation. And the eyes of the skulls here are all coat leaves. But it's all craft paper. And it goes all into the garbage after it's finished. It's a beautiful idea. Such intricate, filigrane work. You throw it away. It's really... In English you say altars. In Spanish we say ofrendas. They're actually offerings. Altars are permanent things in the church. And offerings are things that you do cyclically and take it off. I was just in New Delhi last year, November. I went with my grandson, 14 years old, just changed voice. He has a low voice, my grandson. And he's 14, and we traveled together to do a Day of the Dead in homage to all those Indians who'd never heard of India, and all of those Indians who'd never heard of Mexico. And a whole bunch of Indians, real Indians, from India, gathered. It must have been about 20, 25 youngsters from the art school in New Delhi. And of course, paper was very important. The Indians make beds for their deceased to lie before they're cremated. And so we repeated these beds, and they're all made out of paper. That's the final Day of the Dead installation, where we fused. The syncretism was just great. And they really enjoyed it. Those two flying figures up top have something to do with it. I didn't quite understand it, because even though English is a common language, very few of them actually really spoke English. So we got along with scissors, pencils, drawings, and blackboard, and it really came out nice. They were actually very thrilled to get back their name. And we've always tried to, I don't know how you can underline that great historical mistake of calling Indians, of course, the West Indies and so forth, calling them Indians. Now it's an insult. I met a friend of mine in New York the other day, and he said, "So how are the Indians in Mexico?" He's an Indian. And I said, "Well, it's just like you Indians here." And he looked at me and I said, "Women." And you realize that you can't just say Indians, because it's a bad word for some people. This is a big Day of the Dead installation made of paper. And I'm stressing now, not just standing, not just the printing, but also now the use of paper. And that was made in Caracas right after the big mudslide of the virus. And on the sides of it, there's about 1,000 little strips of paper for people to fill out the names of their relatives they lost. And in fact, they got filled out, all these little pieces of paper. We're filled up by these. The show was, the exhibition was very meaningful, because it came just a few weeks after the tragedy and people still hadn't found all the body behind it. So it was quite touching. And it was a very, very large, very meaningful public. There were over 6,000 people at the opening. And what I'm trying to say is that art is not just art. Art, the way I see it and the way I practice it, has to address something very, very definite at a given moment. And for most of my life, I've tried to make art that can open a dialogue, not just put myself into it and say, "Look, me, I'm an artist and this is my work." No, I think if I chose that because it has to be a vehicle to communicate and to actually get points across and receive feedback. I think that's very, very important if you're going to do art, if you're going to be arty throughout your life. And as I say, more than just a bookmaker, I like Iria. It's so related, art, to artillery. It's the same root word. So I like the idea that art really can have a meaning, even to my next door neighbors. I was telling a friend here that you don't look for a book artist, for a book artist, you don't look for a public for your books. You make your public. Go out there and you sell it to your neighbor, you sell it to this person, you say, you don't go out looking for a public. You have to find it, you have to make it, and it's right there. And I like teaching. The Art of Bookmaking. And I think a talk that I gave, I don't remember what I think, must have been a visual studies workshop in Rochester. We had a big collection of the books we made around. At that time, there were about 400 small presses that I have stimulated into being. There's over 1,600 small presses now that are second, third, fourth, fifth generation presses that are started by people that work with somebody else, that work with somebody else. And of course, it's still, mimeography is still very used. It's still quite widespread because not everybody has computers. Here they're cutting the stencils. That's a little light box so you can actually draw on the stencils. And of course, the beautiful moment in making books is the collating of all its leaves. And there I am, some years been after, on the same, sitting on the same stool there, same place, Dresden. Now I have a mustache, and I decided to face myself, and I've never done that, and I think this is a perfect opportunity to face myself. As you can see, I can bend my legs much easier when I was younger. Holding up, I'm holding up right now. Not limping. But I like the idea of the beau geste effect. And that's, I think, what we are all about. We should feel out there that we're much more, and that we're much stronger than what we think we are, or that we see ourselves as being. Because that's what he's about. I doodle all year long, so I brought a couple of doodles just for you to look at. I make thousands of doodles. And that's when I showed my friends, he says, there's too many colors in your damn thing. So, this shirt, and, well, I'm not going to stop. I hope we have to get and share comments and talk to each other a little bit now and maybe answer questions or whatever. I'll turn this off so you don't get nervous. And if there is no floor mic, is there? So just shout your comments out.
You have to shout when you speak a little bit.
It sounds like a short chord. Yeah.
So if you have any comments, let me know. Any ideas, any feedback? She liked the PowerPoint.
I want to ask you about that large book that had the stamping horses leg.
Yes.
I was utterly thrilled to see it on your website.
Yes.
And I wonder, where does it live and where are its models?
Well, I hope it still is alive because the institutions make it lose everything. All these things are so big that I stored them in some large warehouses the National Institute for Fine Arts has. And as long as my friend, the director, because we're not a merit-oriented society, we're a clan-oriented society, so yeah. Mexico. So my friend is the director, as long as he's still the director, I know that those things may be there. But if he leaves them, I don't know what they're going to do, throw them away. They're lovely. But they actually traveled to Canada, they traveled to, they opened the Olympic Games in some Olympic Games in Atlanta, they traveled to Caracas, they traveled around, and they're resting. I haven't seen them for a good time. All I see is photographs. They're so big, you know. I have the little models, though, and I sure would like to make more, but I don't have space for that. I had a very large studio, and it fell down. The first was a hailstorm, and it fell down, and then some vandals came, and they burned it. So fire and water and ice, you know, you start getting to an age where all those things go. It doesn't matter. I mean, you got photographs of it. Any other comments?
What do you find is different between being
about the reception of your honor as a place to work?
I find Brazil a much better market. It's much more open. They're a very self-assured society there, and they're very hospitable to artists and arts. Sao Paulo especially has an extraordinarily good market, and they have very high caliber artists. Mexico does too. But I feel that we've lost our self-esteem in the last 25 years or so. It's not easy to live next to such a big brother that's always stomping around and scaring the living daylights out of you and trying to copy their systems. In Mexico, art has... The curators took over somehow. They're like DJs. DJs, they take art from this and from that, and then they make their statement. And they didn't take it seriously, you know. So artists are not very important now. We have so many here. We're very unimportant there. And the government will just favor artists, and we're very centralized societies, federation. And it's very difficult to do things. I'm having so many troubles. The curators have been working for 2 years now on curating my retrospective show. And you just can't believe how difficult it is just to get people interested in anything. And in Brazil, I have a much better reception. I had a very porno show, large pornographic show. And it wasn't erotic, actually it was obscene. Well, pornography is a very specific word. Obscene means out of stage, off stage. Obscena means off stage. So I like the word obscene because it's in my site. And there's all these giant dicks and cunts and stuff like that. And the catalog has a president's name on it, you know, like Lula's name on it. And that would never happen in Mexico, especially not this Mexico we have right now, this very, very conservative Mexico. So it's a show that I've never shown in Mexico, for example, if that answers your question. Somebody else, I'm here. Yeah.
I just wondered, is there a book happening to you right now, and what is it?
Right, this very second. It is.
This month.
Yes, there's three books happening to me because I just am in love with Adobe. Is that enough? Okay. And so I'm working my ass off to work on Adobe, and I have all these thousands of photographs that I'm working on, and I want to bring out a very large sort of accordion. What do you call it? Concertina? Is that the word? Accordion book, which is very, very much about Mexican pre-Columbian codex format.
That is your modular computers.
Say that. Okay, you just gave it a cover. It's in the works right now. Any other comments? Yeah.
Sort of an affiliation between the permanence of books and their importance, and you're dealing a lot with an ephemeral. So I'd like if you have any thoughts about the importance of the ephemeral in the book.
I should have. But I belong to a generation that started making ephemeral work for real. In other words, we really wanted it to be ephemeral, so much so that I rarely photograph. I have very few photographic records of the work. You know, Barbara and Peter Moore were the only photographers of much of the first 5 or 6 years of Fluxus. Nobody was photographing. Bless you. Everybody was, bless you again. Nobody was photographing, so there's very few photographs. And I'm not the third one. I'm sneezing. Change roles in the movies when I sneeze. I still have faith in the ephemeral. I have faith in that, which is very different from ephemera. You know, ephemera is somebody came around and ransacked my files, and they took a lot of what they call ephemera, and I needed money, so they paid me for that. But they saved it. But ephemeral is actually short-lived. And I like that. If you're really going to dialogue with somebody, you want the dialogue to be live, you're not going to start recording every conversation you have with somebody else. And I think art is about conversing with other people through your books. Now, books themselves are a symbol of permanency. Definitely. And if I didn't respect permanency, I would be lugging around 25,000 books every time I moved. I mean, it's a big, big hassle to take care of books, to move them around, take all the mushrooms away, because usually where I live, it's very humid and tropical and everything. Just taking care of the silverfish, you know, like I hate it, and things like that. I wouldn't be taking all that care if I didn't respect that permanency. And I wouldn't have opened up with Schopenhauer's famous dictum on what books are about. But I think it's a very wonderful tightrope walk between what can be or should be or will be remembered, even if it doesn't exist anymore. I did a lot of works that were designed just for people to remember, to be told. That's why I liked Yoko's show out here, where she describes her works. I just thought, well, I did for many years, I did works that you could describe what they were about to somebody else, and you know how a story and the telling changes. So every storyteller, everybody that tells a story will add a little bit to it. So that ephemerality I like very much. Did that address your
yes. Thank you.
Question?
Last chance.
No more questions? Well, I... Okay.
Do you find any of your themes expand?
Yes. Yeah, when you're about 18, 23, 26, if you're careful, you keep all ideas. And then when you're 32, 34, you put it into practice. And then when you're 48, 53, you go back to them. And now that I'm 64, I'm going back to a whole bunch of them. It's incredible how ideas get reprocessed. It's like reading The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann when you're 17 and then reading it when you're 50. I mean, it's a different, totally different book. And ideas are a little bit like that. You only have so many ideas in life, I think, about 100 a day. And you can capture very few of them. He asked whether ideas kept on coming back, and they certainly do. That's what gives the color. White color to the mustache.
First inspiration when you were a teenager?
I don't know whether inspiration is really the word. The muses, as they said. It's, you know, how an idea gels. I kept a diary for one whole year, and it's still there in book form. It's one of a kind of ideas. And I wrote down, I'm pointing at her because she remembers this book. I wrote down exactly how I woke up, and I had an idea, so I wrote down where. Coming out of the bathroom, just taking a shit, you break down the idea. And you take a bus, and then you get another idea because of the last one. So I wrote it down, and for a whole year I wrote about down how ideas came to me. And I don't know whether the word is inspiration, but for my retrospective show right now, they asked me for some sort of autobiography. And what I chose to do was a series of chronologies. I did four major chronologies, they're not very long, of what happened to me in life. From the moment I was born, that whatever I can remember in my home, in my parents' house, later on, the things that were happening, cryptology, for example, nanotechnology. My parents received Norbert Wiener for 5 or 6 years. Every year, Norbert Wiener used to go to Mexico, and if I hadn't been 9, 10 years old, I would have been, you know, he was more or less to present coin to the word cybernetics. And those things happen to you. And that they have a way of sifting to the bottom and becoming an important sediment. So I'm not sure whether that word is inspiration, but what one reacts to is actually what one lives in.
Well, I find myself, I'll have an inspiration, an idea, and I don't know how deep it is, but it starts going,
yeah.
And then that, to me, that's the inspiration. Then it might take 3 or 4 years to complete the work.
You know, because it's
so that, you know,
10% inspiration, 80% work, right?
Inspired, you know,
yeah. Well, the writer's block is, an artist of every sort is also a block. It's always good to keep ideas for every season, for every time, you know what I mean? What I do now, you look through and then you have the idea. Any other questions?
Yeah.
So I thank Codex Foundation. I'm very glad that we're witnessing the beginning of a new tradition, meeting every 2 years under the Codex banner. Thank you very, very much.
Master of Ceremonies hat for just another minute. For the rest of the day, that is the day part of our day, from now until 6 p.m. when we're having the opening gala, bring your checkbook, bring your books, let's have some fun at the book fair. We're basically, we're open and free to do what it is that we please. And those of us who are wearing yellow badges as exhibitors, are encouraged to go to the Pauley Ballroom between now and 6 and meet one another, hang out, arrange your table just the way you want, walk away from it, don't worry about it, go to other tables, look at, meet our German friends, meet our South American friends, meet our British friends, our Canadian friends, our friends from New England, our friends from the Deep South, our friends from far away. So we're all here to meet one another and to bridge the obvious gap that divides us, which is quite obviously time and space. But now we're all here and we should be taking as much advantage of it as we can. We programmed this event so that there would be a lot of schmooze time. Okay, so those of us who are not wearing yellow badges but are wearing symposium badges, you are secretly allowed in with those of us who are wearing yellow badges. But it's not publicly known. Okay? So the public is absolutely not invited. The public is definitely excluded from the next few hours, just so that we can really acquaint ourselves with one another and prepare ourselves for some food. Now, Susan Filter, oh, and then there's the photographing of the books.
Jim's already started that.
Okay. Now, this is an issue of which I am sadly deficient in knowledge. But there is a photographer, Douglas Sandberg. There is an editor, David Jury. And there are books, lots of books with us. And so the photographing has begun. And it's going to now continue until perhaps 11 o'clock at night, at least late this evening. And then tomorrow is going to be a blast of photographing from about 7 a.m., we think, until whatever time, 9:30 at night. And then there'll be a last chance for photographing on Thursday. The object of this is to document the work that you brought as well as we can. We're using only one photographer so that there will be some, symmetry from one photograph to the next. And what we hope to do is then document this and in book form. I don't know what promises, I don't remember the promises we've made. We probably won't be able to keep them. But we will do our damnedest, I promise you that. Okay? We'll do the best job that we can given the limited time and the limited resources. And of course, what really limits our resources is how much energy we put into it. So there will be an energetic push in the near future to raise a ton of money so that we'll have really high production value on our book so that it looks good, feels good. We want a little 12-pounder. We want a sort of a giant book out there that's showing people what we can and do. And no promises that there'll be another one afterwards, but we hope that this is just the beginning of something that's going to take on a life of its own. And in the spirit of Felipe Ehrenberg and his book, Yes Press, and all of his family and all of his friends, I'm so glad to have him and his energy and his input, and he's an inspiration to me. And so let's wander over to the ballroom and have a ball. Thanks.